You're listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton.
Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here with our weekly update here on social media. Thank you as always for joining us. So much going on here with the attacks on Trump, major developments in that regard. We have major new developments, believe it or not, on the Hillary Clinton email scandal. New documents that are just outrageous about Biden's dog attacking everybody over at the White House. And when I mean everybody, I'm only slightly exaggerating. Plus, Hunter Biden was here testifying. All sorts of other craziness happening that I want to be sure I'm able to get into it all. Plus, we had CPAC last weekend, and I gave, if I do say so myself, a pretty darn powerful speech about the current crisis. And we're going to play that here for you a little bit later, so be sure to stay tuned. First up, I'm running a little bit late here because the Associated Press, in pure left-wing, dishonest, partisan, unethical, in my view, fashion, sent us a request for a comment at 1:45 in the middle of Friday afternoon, which is typical media dishonesty in terms of dealing with stories like this, asking for our response to outrageous allegations about Ashley Babbitt. We're representing her widower and her estate in the $30 million wrongful death lawsuit against the federal government. And, without getting into the details of the back and forth about it, it's just another example of the left-wing media trying to dismiss and minimize the fact that Ashley was killed for no good reason by a U.S. Capitol Police officer, illicitly killed, shot dead. And they're asking us for information about what Ashley supposedly did in some situation. And our biggest response is, we can't ask her because she's dead. And of course, they know that. That's why they wait to the last minute on a Friday afternoon to ask us the question. So if I'm particularly angry this evening, it's because I've been dealing with the dishonest liberal media. But first up, we've got some updates about the efforts to destroy Donald Trump, which is kind of all part of a piece here. If you're talking about even the efforts to destroy Ashley Babbitt, who, of course, was a Trump supporter. The Supreme Court, in a massive blow to Jack Smith and the Biden regime and all their leftist cadres out there, decided to take up President Trump's challenge to the notion that he can be prosecuted for acts he committed officially as President of the United States. And the Supreme Court took it up just the other day, and I had this initial reaction to it.
Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here with some breaking news. President Trump got a big victory just now at the Supreme Court, a big loss for the Biden regime, Jack Smith, and the rabid anti-Trump courts. The Supreme Court agreed to take up President Trump's challenge to the effort by the Biden gang to jail him for his official acts as President of the United States related to the 2020 election. The Supreme Court has stayed the proceedings, which means the case against him below can't proceed before the anti-Trump judge Chutkin until at least the middle of the year, if at all, depending on how the Supreme Court rules. So big victory for the rule of law, constitutional government, and our republic today.
And the left is furious because their efforts to bum rush President Trump into a criminal trial where they plan to convict him because it's a D.C. jury, they're all Democrats here, has been waylaid by the Supreme Court. So they're going to hear his case in April, so they are moving a bit more quickly than they otherwise would. In theory, they could have waited till next term, but they're still deferring to the government, in my view, too much, the Biden administration. And so if they uphold Trump's challenge, the case essentially dies. And even if they don't, The case will be delayed in a way that it makes it very difficult, unless they really want to abuse the rule of law and just completely try to rig the election with no embarrassment. It would delay the trial till after the election, which the left is desperate to avoid, because they think if Trump wins, he'll pardon himself or shut down the prosecution, as is his right as president. So we'll see what happens. But the Supreme Court was right to take up the case. What you're going to be seeing in the next 2 months, as they prepare to hear this Trump challenge fully, is again another effort by the crazed left to intimidate the courts. Now, you remember during the debate about whether to allow states to protect human life over the Roe versus Wade decision, how the left was intimidating the courts then, showing up illegally outside the homes of justices to try to intimidate them. And that never stopped, by the way. It never stopped. But now you see Pelosi out there attacking the court, and all the leftists out there attacking the court. And by the way, this decision to take up the case had no noted dissents. And it would seem to me, if there was a strong opposition to it, one of the left-wing judges, or maybe, who knows, maybe one of the conservative judges would have taken, made their public dissent known, but they didn't. So it's pretty clear the entire court doesn't trust the corrupt or politicized D.C. courts here in Washington, D.C., who are so there are some good judges, but for most of them have been kind of brainwashed. The Republicans and the Republican appointees and the Democrats are anti-Trump as it is. And so they're just crazily anti-Trump. And to the degree there are any sensible judges, they're in the absolute minority here in the D.C. federal courts. So it's a big blow also to the lower courts in that regard, too, who have kind of blessed virtually every anti-Trump move the Biden administration has wanted to make and blown up Trump's civil rights in the process. And of course, the left doesn't want you to be able to vote for Trump. I've said it once, and I'm going to make it dramatically in the speech you'll later hear. The left wants to turn this country into a one-party state. And what better way to do that than to knock the number one opponent off the ballot? Now, Trump made some news this weekend at CPAC by suggesting he was a political dissident. I think that's a fair way of characterizing it. Heck, I think I'm a dissident. I've been abused by the government based on my perceived political beliefs and for doing things that we're allowed to do here at Judicial Watch under the First Amendment. Yeah, you can have dissidents in a country where the party in power, and I don't mean party literally partisan-wise, I mean party in terms of attitude, thinks that they can harass and jail and do worse to their political opponents. So kudos to the Supreme Court for stepping up and hopefully enforcing the rule of law and protecting our constitutional system. And so they're going to be deciding whether or not the president has immunity for his official acts. Now, they've previously found that he has immunity from civil cases for acts did in his official capacity, or a president does in their official capacity. And so the question is, does that same logic or similar logic apply to immunity from criminal liability? And I think there's a strong argument that he does. I mean, there's only one president at a time. And as Justice John Marshall, one of the most important justices in the history of the country, if not Western jurisprudence, found, under our constitutional system, the courts can't review presidential acts. So what Joe Biden is asking the Supreme Court to do is to overturn Marbury versus Madison. Now, those of you who are lawyers who have followed the history of constitutional law in the United States, you will know that that's the most important, arguably the most important Supreme Court decision in American history, because it established the approach that the courts take in terms of judicial review and their right to do so. So Who's the extremist? They're saying that Trump is making this outrageous attempt to be above the law and, you know, ask for immunity that isn't his to take. And the response to that is what he's asking for is that the Constitution that guides the rule of law here in the United States be enforced. And you're not asking to be put above the law when you're asking that the Constitution that allows you to do X, Y, or Z be enforced. He's asking that the rule of law be upheld. So that's at issue here. And the other big developments, so you've got this crazy case up against Trump for daring to dispute the election, which the Supreme Court has significantly delayed and likely will effectively delay even if it's allowed to go forward at all till after the election. You still have this Fulton County case down in Georgia that's been irredeemably compromised, in my view, by Fannie Willis and her affair with the special prosecutor she hired. And it looks like their criminality in covering up that affair. So there's been new developments in the sense that President Trump's lawyers were able to obtain cell phone data that showed that Nathan Wade was basically going around her house. I mean, I guess cell phone data wasn't specific enough to figure out what apartment he was visiting when he was in that general area, but it was pretty clear based circumstantially what the records show, that he was in the air, you know, basically at her home, practically speaking, and then he'd be at his, then in the middle of the night, he'd go home and then text her. It's pretty damning material. So that information is out there, further undermining their denials that they only began their affair after she hired him, as if that's good enough or perfectly appropriate and doesn't raise conflict issues just with that. But if the affair began before she hired him, you know, that would just escalate the issue, and it looks like that's the case, and that they were lying about it. So this is a criminal issue, in my view, for Fannie Willis, in addition to these ethics issues about whether she and her office will be dismissed from the case, or whether the case itself will be completely dismissed because, as I said, it's been irredeemably compromised. And the court has concluded its hearings, and I think they had closing arguments. I wasn't able to catch them, but I understand they were pretty powerful in terms of making the case against Fannie Willis. And I talked about this the other day with Carl Higbee on Newsmax, and let's play a clip from that. Well, these are political prosecutions, right? And there's that corruption. On top of that, which we often see where tyrants seek to jail their enemies, those same tyrants are lining their pockets. So this whole process of prosecuting Trump before these two grand juries and these other Americans has been, in my view, irredeemably tainted by this relationship where they were using the money that Wade was earning as a result of his relationship, as being hired by Fannie, to advance their romantic interests and go on a vacation spree. You know, how many vacations do they go on together with once they started dating, even by their own admission?
Right.
What, 4, 5, or 6?
Yeah. And the problem is all these investigations are fueled by taxpayer dollars. And
just quickly, I mean, we saw in the Mueller investigation, at the federal case against Trump, you had the two FBI agents, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page. Remember, they had that illicit relationship going with this anti-Trump bias that infected that investigation, so much so they were forced out. Yeah, let's not forget, this isn't the first time, right? And it helps explain, in my view, why Jack Smith doesn't want to tell us who his top people are working for him. Because these are the sorts of questions they're going to be asked. Do they have a bias? Do they have relationships, political or otherwise, that people would question whether it's appropriate for them to try to jail, to be involved in trying to jail a president? And does that type of potential bias raise questions, in addition to the obvious political nature of the charges, that the charges shouldn't have been brought to begin with? I mean, if Jack Smith went and found and only hired Democrat donors,
Don't we have a right to know that? If Fannie Willis, just like if Fannie Willis hired her lover, don't you think we would have had a right to know that? Doesn't that compromise the whole mess further? Sure does. And that's why Fannie Willis is furious about these allegations, and because she sees the writing on the wall. And that's why Jack Smith and the Biden Justice Department are desperately trying to keep the names of the people working on Trump's prosecution away from Judicial Watch and the American people. Remember, we're not asking for Judicial Watch. I mean, legally, we're asking for Judicial Watch. We're in court over it. But we're asking on behalf of the American people for access to information about what the government's up to. And these prosecutions are unprecedented. And we should have access to this basic information about their effort to, in my view, rig an election and throw a president in jail for political reasons. And one of the reasons they want to do it is because Biden has all these corruption issues himself. What better way to distract from that than to throw all these spurious charges at Trump? Now, Hunter testified finally before the House impeachment folks earlier this week, and it was right down the office from us. And so our team went down there, and I went down there at least to kind of see what was going on outside. And it's a congressional office building, so we can get in and see what's happening. And this was our report on the scene there. Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here. We're outside where Hunter Biden's being deposed. Let's go inside, it's raining.
I'm inside the House office building where Hunter Biden is finally being deposed by impeachment investigators. Better late than never. It's kind of a scandal that took so long. But we all know how the testimony is going to go. He's going to protect his father, pretend he did nothing wrong. But the evidence is overwhelming. That there was a transnational racketeering operation that had at its head Joe Biden. And in terms of impeachment, there's never been a more powerful case for impeachment against a president of the United States. So the House should accelerate its investigation, consider bringing Joe in to testify, and you can bet that Judicial Watch will continue to pursue its well over a dozen FOIA lawsuits to get information on this Biden corruption crisis.
So afterwards, a few days later, after that was recorded, the House committee released the transcript of Hunter Biden's testimony, and I was able to review it. It was 230 pages or so, and I've read a lot of deposition transcripts, and this was pretty strange, and I kind of had an initial reaction here I'll share with you.
Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here. I just reviewed carefully the Hunter Biden deposition transcript. Hunter confirms that his father was, despite Joe Biden's denials, involved in Hunter's businesses in meeting after meeting after meeting. He magically called in, spoke to Hunter's business associates, including associates from abroad. Of course, Hunter tries to deny he was technically involved, but his testimony speaks for itself. And then secondly, his testimony is at odds with the text messages he had sent and the testimony of many others. And I don't think he comes across terribly well. Certainly based on the written testimony, it seems he's a bit out of control throughout the entire deposition process. Most importantly, or surprisingly, we find out that he actually had a meeting in the Chinese embassy when Joe Biden was vice president to drum up Chinese-related investing. Really incredible. So this is more confirmation that Joe Biden was less than forthcoming about his involvement in Hunter's businesses, and the deposition itself is troubling in highlighting how his son was out of control and obviously working to use Joe to advance his personal and professional interests in a way that resulted in millions of dollars flowing from overseas into his coffers.
Well, I would add some additional observations to my initial ones there. I encourage you to read the deposition transcript, including the section of the transcript in which Congressman Matt Gaetz does an excellent job questioning Hunter on that strange meeting he had during the presidency of Obama. And obviously his father was vice president at the Chinese embassy. Not only that, but he also had a dinner with a key Chinese minister from the embassy as well, or I guess he was visiting. But what universe would it be appropriate for the son of a vice president to be doing business transactions at the Chinese embassy, trying to raise money for investing in China at the Chinese embassy while his father is vice president? And of course, this is all in the context of him using that office to leverage and actually have his father involved in some of these Chinese business enterprises that he was ginning up while he was vice president and shortly thereafter. And if you read the testimony, he doesn't really deny to any significant or persuasive effect that his father was involved in these businesses. And he says it's perfectly normal for him to be in business meetings and his father to kind of magically appear and just show up in person or call in the middle of the meeting and he gets thrown on the speakerphone. Look, many of you are involved in business. How many times did your parents call you in the middle of a business meeting and you put them on the phone? We know what he was doing. He put him on the speakerphone, or he showed up for these meetings and was involved with these foreign nationals that Hunter was doing business with, and he was present at these meetings because he was blessing the deal. Hunter was in getting these deals because of his father. And when you see how the money was laundered through the various companies Hunter was involved in and the dishonesty he had in describing that, you're going to see a deposition that confirms a racketeering operation. I mean, one of the, I guess, laughable arguments Hunter was making was how important he and how successful and how significant his business experience was that made it perfectly reasonable that he would be hired to run Burisma's corporate governance operation as a board member for $1 million a year or whatever the number was. And what he would do is he would say, well, I was on the board of Amtrak or on the boards of these other companies. The only reason he was on the board of Amtrak because his father was the senator from Amtrak. He took the Amtrak train every day up to Delaware when he was a senator. Probably his vice president, he kept on using it. I don't know if he did, but wouldn't surprise me. So Amtrak was the Biden's baby in terms of funding and having oversight and influence with. Of course, Hunter got on the board of Amtrak. He also got on the board of MBNA, which was a massive, I don't think it's around as much anymore, but back in the day, at least I remember it being a massive credit card company up in Delaware. How did he get on the board? I think he was 30-something, because his father was Joe Biden. So he goes into this testimony saying, well, I had all these other board, he didn't say it like this, but this is how I interpreted it. I had all these other boards that I sat on as a result of my father's influence. I mean, he describes an influence peddling operation, bar none. So, what's going to happen next? They got to just get to the impeachment, right? Are they going to have a vote on impeachment or not? Now, there are some Republicans who have their head in the sand with Biden, and don't think there's evidence of impeachable offenses, lying about your business relationships with foreign nationals, that's not impeachable. While you're president of the United States, foreign nationals that are creatures of the Chinese and Russian governments, that's not acceptable. And of course, then you have the Biden border invasion, that's not impeachable. The abuse of Trump, that's not impeachable. So I'm not quite sure of the thinking there. So Of course, you know, the Republicans have, you know, they have two heads on this, right? It's like a double, it's like Jekyll and Hyde. I don't know if Jekyll and Hyde is the right way of putting it. But once again, for instance, they just fully funded everything that they say they oppose in the Biden administration with another continuing resolution. They're fully funding the Biden border invasion again. The abuses of Trump by Jack Smith, censorship of you. You name everything you don't like about the Biden administration, they haven't gotten, they haven't stopped $1 flowing to it. And they keep on funding it through these continuing resolutions. Although there was some good news this week, I will say there was some good news this week, and I'd like to think that we played a significant role, is that the Speaker Johnson, along with his responsible colleague, Congressman Loudermilk, announced that the January 6th videos are finally all going to come out. And what had been slowing them down was they were trying to blur out the faces of people who were participating at the protest or, and were involved in the disturbance. And that wasn't working. I mean, it's, technically, it's been nearly impossible to do in a way that would balance their privacy interests with the rights of the people to have access to this important information. So they just released a bunch of the videos today, and they plan to release the rest in tranches over the next few weeks. So we'll see what happens there. And Judicial Watch, of course, still has ongoing litigation to try to get these records under the common law right of access to public information. Now, if they release all the videos in a way that gets us the result, I mean, I guess that would be fine, right? But we'll see what happens. But kudos to Speaker Johnson in the short term for just cutting to the chase and finally getting these videos out. Now, I said that once before, and then the videos were delayed and stalled for weeks and months, but hopefully we get the full release now. So that's some good news. Speaking of the Biden border invasion, I don't want to talk about the border invasion because I've highlighted how we're funding it. But Biden and Trump went down to the border this week. And I don't want to talk about it in a sense because I think there's another important issue is Biden's inability, evidently, to serve because of his cognitive and physical challenges. And I saw this video of him walking around at the border the other day. And I mean, I posted this kind of reaction video on social media. So there he is at the border with some Border Patrol agents. And he barely can walk, it looks like. I mean, Governor Abbott is in a wheelchair and gets around more easily than Biden did. And this is what I would do in reaction to something like that if I were in Congress. I think Congress should initiate hearings regarding the 25th Amendment and start bringing in witnesses, doctors, and people around Biden and explore what's going on, explain to the American people what the 25th Amendment is designed to do, which is to remove a president when there is a significant disability like this. The vice president and his cabinet can move the act and remove him. And if the president doesn't dispute it, he's removed. If he does dispute it, it requires, I think, a two-thirds vote in Congress in order for the removal to be effected under the 25th Amendment. But these are the sorts of debates we should be having. I mean, I don't want to joke about his cognitive difficulties. I think it's disturbing. Now, others will joke, but I don't want to joke in the sense that we've got bad guys watching very carefully what we're doing, and they look to the president for signs of weakness. And if they see that weakness, they'll take advantage of it. Even our friends will take advantage of it. So these have significant national security implications. So there we have there's the story there that we got to take his cognitive challenges seriously. And I know some people say, well, you know, we'll have Kamala Harris. Well, that's life. All I know is that there's what the current situation's untenable. It really is. And then it'll be a different challenge if there's a different president or vice president. Now I'm saying, does he have to be removed on the 25th Amendment? I think there needs to be a serious debate about it. And Congress can lead the way in it. So, back to Hillary. We had a major announcement this week. Let me go to the videotape again where I announced it earlier this week. And be prepared, you're going to see a picture of Hillary Clinton, so it may trigger you. But here we go.
Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here with some breaking news about Hillary Clinton herself. We just settled our big Hillary Clinton email scandal lawsuit. This is the FOIA lawsuit about Benghazi initially that led to the uncovering of Clinton's email system that she tried to hide and involved the misuse and abuse of classified information and pay-to-play scandals and such. Well, the State Department just settled that with us for $97,000. Now, this lawsuit led to this woman losing the presidency. That was the consequence of it. And of course, President Trump won the presidency. So in many ways, this is the most important FOIA lawsuit in American history. Now, of course, Hillary Clinton ignored the law, but still received special treatment from both the courts and law enforcement, unfortunately. And for countless Americans, this double standard of justice destroyed their confidence in the fair administration of justice, a confidence which remains diminished to this day. But Americans would never have known about Hillary Clinton's classified email scam, her related pay-to-play scandals, but for Judicial Watch's diligence. So, big news today. The Hillary Clinton email scandal is over, but Hillary Clinton's never going away, so never forget.
So let me give you the background on this story. It all began with the Benghazi attack in 2012, September 11th, 2012. We saw immediately they were lying about what happened there. We began a series of lawsuits, FOIA requests, followed by lawsuits to gain access to that information. And the one thing we noticed about our initial Benghazi lawsuit, this is the lawsuit that really broke open the Benghazi scandal, because we were able to get documents that Congress hadn't been able to get, and it led to the creation of a select committee. And this key document that we obtained was a White House document showing that they were the ones who came up with the big lie that it was a video that made them do it, as opposed to the terrorists that quite obviously were involved in the killing and murder of our U.S. ambassador, his associate in the State Department, a young guy, and then two special operators associated with the CIA a few hours later. One thing we noticed in those documents was there were no Hillary Clinton emails. So shortly thereafter, we filed another lawsuit. And we basically got back the same types of emails we had had in the initial email, in the first big lawsuit I told you about. And Ramona Kotka, who was our lawyer on the team, maybe we can throw up a picture of at least me and Ramona, or a picture of Ramona. I think we had some videos this week that we posted of interviews we had done about Ramona's fights for the documents. But Ramona saw that in the next set of lawsuits, or in this big lawsuit we're talking about, that they just gave us more of the same, basically a repeat. And they said, "What?" And she said, "Is there anything else there? What about Hillary's emails?" And their response was kind of cryptic. It was in the end of 2014. And they said, well, we may have something else. And then finally, in February, I think it was, of 2015, they admitted to the court that we've given Judicial Watch everything but this other set of documents we have. And then a few weeks later, it's leaked. It was Hillary's emails. And so as a result of Judicial Watch's FOIA litigation, they were forced to admit they had the emails. And the emails led, as I highlight in my introductory video to you, to Hillary Clinton being caught up in a criminal investigation that was largely wired, because we saw up front because we were up close to it, how it was wired. We also exposed through this litigation that I'm talking about now and other lawsuits that involved Hillary Clinton's emails, the handling of her emails by Huma Abedin, her husband then husband. Now I'm forgetting her husband's name. What was it?
Anthony Weiner.
Anthony Weiner. That's right. How could I forget Anthony Weiner's name? And then we had gotten all of these documents from her emails and Yuma Abedin's emails documenting pay to play at the Clinton State Department, where their donors, including foreign nationals, were using their contacts with the Clinton State, the Clinton Foundation, to get in good and get favors from the Clinton State Department. And that essentially just led to her losing the election. Now, others will say, well, there are other reasons she lost. But this was the primary reason. The whole situation around her scandal led, in my view, to her losing the election. Now, did we do it to make her lose the election? No. But we began asking for these records. I personally thought she wasn't even going to run for president. So her running for president, to me at least, was a surprise. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. I'm not as smart politically as people think. I'm kind of naive. I think, why would she want to run for president again, given her record? Well, some people are just awful enough that they think they can do anything they want with no accountability. And, you know, in Hillary's case, she's guessed largely right about that. But she did get accountability through at least our litigation. And, you know, there was kind of a rough form of accountability in the election contest because Trump won and she lost, right? So if the American people were sitting as a grand jury on Election Day, they voted guilty, right, for Hillary when they elected President Trump to office. So this litigation exposed so much in the way of corruption, not only by Hillary Clinton and criminality by Hillary Clinton, and I say this litigation, but the whole series of litigations around this issue by Judicial Watch, I would have to write a book. Indeed, we have written books about how important the disclosures were in this litigation. I'm going to go through a few of the disclosures. And this stuff is worth going over again because it's so outrageous that nothing was done about it in terms of criminal prosecutions. And when you compare and contrast what Hillary did in terms of walking off with classified information and government documents, no, they weren't her personal emails when she wrote about government business and then left office. They became government emails. And by their own admission, they were government emails because we wouldn't have been able to get them through FOIA if they were just her, quote, personal emails. Listen to this. John Hackett, who was a former IT professional, Information Programs and Services Director, testified he had raised concerns that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's staff may have culled 30,000 of the Secretary's personal emails without following National Archives standards. The same agency that wants to jail Trump for asserting his executive prerogatives in terms of holding records let Hillary destroy records, and no crimes were prosecuted. He also revealed that he believed there was interference with the formal FOIA review process related to the classification of Clinton's Benghazi emails. Now, I'm convinced this is kind of a weird thing for a transparency group to complain about, but I've looked at, I would fair to say, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of documents over my decades at Judicial Watch now. And when I looked at the Clinton emails and records that they were producing from her email cache, it occurred to me that we were getting documents that typically would have been considered classified in my experience. You kind of know what the triggers are for classification because we're always arguing about it, because we're always saying, well, it shouldn't be classified. And they tell us why it's classified. And so based on what the government often told us, I saw that they were not classifying records that they probably could have. And you know why? Because the more records they classified, the more legal liability and political liability Hillary had. So they were willing to, in my view, release information that arguably should have been classified to protect Hillary. I mean, that's how craven they were. And this is what I think that official was referencing. Heather Samuelson, Hillary Clinton's White House liaison at the State Department, so she worked for her at the State Department, and then later became her personal lawyer, admitted under oath she was granted immunity by the Department of Justice in June of 2016. So her lawyer, by the way, was also the one who, quote, deleted those 30,000 emails. And they granted her immunity for doing it. Justin Cooper, the former aide to Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation employee who set up the domain of the unsecured ClintonEmail.com server, testified he worked with Yuma Abedin to create the non-governmental email system. And Abedin was working at the State Department at the time. We also got the FBI, a senior FBI official, to admit that Obama knew. How? They found Clinton emails in the Obama White House, specifically the Executive Office of the President. Jake Sullivan, who's now the National Security Advisor for President Biden, he was a Clinton aide. You didn't know that, I'm sure, because the media doesn't like to tell you the backgrounds of their friends. But if Jake Sullivan were a Republican and he had a similar background, he'd never be in the White House. He and Clinton used her unsecure non-governmental email system to conduct official State Department business. So her top advisor knew she was doing this in the State Department. A Secretary of State for Diplomatic Security twice warned Clinton about using unsecure BlackBerries and personal emails to transmit classified information. So she was warned. It wasn't like she was just doing it innocently, like no one warned her about it. She was warned twice. So that's just kind of like the surface of what happened. I mean, we, of course, in this case also, we had Hillary Clinton ordered to be deposed by a district court judge, Judge Royce Lamberth. And Judge Lamberth kind of waited, you know, a year, I think it was 2 or 3 years after the cases had percolated before he authorized us to allow her to be deposed. And what happened was she went and appealed that ruling to the D.C. Court of Appeals in an extraordinary, what they call mandamus action. It's very unusual. You're basically kind of short-circuiting the regular appeals process to get the appeals court to stop the lower court from doing something. And, of course, the leftists on the Court of Appeals granted Hillary a dispensation from having to testify. They basically upended FOIA law and agreed that she's too busy to have to testify about records she took by the tens of thousands, including classified effort records, to thwart our FOIA request. So she got this special protection from the courts. Susan Rice was supposed to be deposed too. She knew about the Benghazi emails. They protected her. Really outrageous. So, it's been years now, 2015, 14, it's almost 10 years. I was 10 years younger. And we, in my view, broke open the biggest scandal to date at that time, and it changed the course of history. So when you're in FOIA, you usually are able to get fees if you kind of are, you know, you succeed in your lawsuit in getting the government to release documents, and I'm really kind of simplifying it, you are able to get certain fees for your trouble. And obviously, we succeeded and then some with Clinton. Now, the problem with asking for fees is that the government often opposes it, and so you could create a lot of additional time and expense in fighting over the fees. But in this case, the government agreed with us to settle and gave us an amount of $97,000, and it did clear. We did get the deposit. Let's show the deposit. There you have it. State Treasury came to us on February 20th, 2024, $97,000. So it's a settlement. So a settlement, to be clear, they don't admit doing anything wrong, and we can't use that settlement to say they did anything wrong. But certainly people can draw their own conclusions about why they settled, right? So it's a big deal. I mean, the Clinton email scandal is over, but Hillary's still out there. She set up her foundations in the influence peddling game again, so she's got the for sale sign out there. I'm convinced she still wants to be president of the United States. Politically, I don't understand why she would still be out there making all these comments and involved in public policy if she didn't have her sights on the presidency. I think she sees Joe Biden as someone who might leave the presidency soon, and so she may want to step in again. And I think these corruption scandals are going to erupt again, because to me, they've never been handled fully and appropriately. So I'm upset about the way Hillary Clinton got away with a lot, but as I described earlier, there was a lot she didn't get away with, and she was held accountable to a certain extent. And let me be clear, if it weren't for Judicial Watch, you wouldn't know one thing about the Clinton emails. If it weren't for Judicial Watch and our disclosures about her emails, we'd probably be in a second Clinton administration right now. And as I said, it's not because we were opposing her nomination or candidacy, because that's not what we do. That was the consequence of what we did. So it's quite the historic lawsuit. And I would submit that our Benghazi litigation, which led to the creation of the Select Committee, which uncovered the Clinton emails, was the most significant non-governmental investigation in American history in terms of its impact. So it's vindication, in my view, to get to have this case end the way it did. But I have a feeling when it comes to Clinton corruption, we haven't seen the end of it, though. So you can be sure we'll be continuing our keeping an eye on the Clinton machine up there in Chappaqua. You know, another big issue that we've been involved in, in many ways a thankless way, because the major media had zero interest in pursuing it to any great extent, was this crazed issue of Joe and Jill Biden allowing their dogs to attack Secret Service agents, and only something being done about it when Judicial Watch uncovered it. We exposed how back in when they had their first dog, Major, a German Shepherd, Major was attacking Secret Service agents much more significantly in terms of number and severity than the Biden White House had admitted to. And so we were able to uncover that through the FOIA process. And that led to poor Major having to leave the White House, and they got a second dog. Then we got a tip that Commander was also out of control. And that led to FOIA litigation and investigations that uncovered at least 10 Commander dog attack bites and attacks in the summer of 2000. I guess it was last summer. It was July, I think. And the Biden people said, oh, you know, we're handling it. Don't worry, don't worry. And then CNN reported there was even more than they had admitted to in the documents to Judicial Watch. And we had separately uncovered through a source that Joe Biden abused his dogs. He kicks them and messes with them. So he abuses the dogs. And so as a result of a subsequent lawsuit, because we thought there was more there, more documents were released. Now, they were first reported by CNN, but we had caused their release. And the documents are astonishing. They show that records reveal that at least 23 biting incidents occurred just in a few months there at the Biden White House, thanks to Commander and, frankly, his owners. And I reported on it or disclosed it earlier this week. Let's go to that video. Hey, everyone. Breaking news. Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here. Secret Service reports
obtained by Judicial Watch FOIA litigation show that Joe Biden's dog Commander was involved in 23 attacks on Secret Service personnel. Absolutely insane stuff. One agent was actually taken down by the dog, and they had to close a public section of the White House for 20 minutes while they cleaned up the blood. Now, Judicial Watch exposed all these dog biting attacks back during Major's time in the White House. They lied about how many people he had bitten, exposed by Judicial Watch. They got the new dog Commander. We got a tip that dog was out of control too, and we exposed there were at least 10 attacks last year. We followed up and found there were 23 attacks. I don't know about you, but I think it's outrageous the Secret Service wasn't protecting its personnel by hiding these attacks on behalf of the Biden administration. And I don't know what's going on in terms of craziness over at the Biden White House with Joe and Jill allowing their dog 25 times, 24 times, 23 times to attack Secret Service personnel that are protecting their lives. I think there's more here, and Judicial Watch will continue to pursue these issues in federal court. Yeah, and when you look at the spreadsheet, it is startling. Let's put up the spreadsheet showing the attacks. So look at that. So you'll see, you know, the location on the body, left arm, left hand, left forearm, right elbow, right wrist. Treatment received. When you see WHMU, that means they went and saw the doctors at the White House Medical Unit. I don't know what that blacked out section means. It doesn't say what the, I can't quite read what the exemption they are citing to keep that material away from us, but maybe it was hospitalization or something else that's private. As I said, they attacked a guy, took him down. They took him down, the dog. And when you see all this wording about right arm, left forearm, et cetera, I mean, that shows people are trying to defend themselves. I mean, I just can't believe it. And so, you know, just think about what a dog, you've seen like dog attack videos where they're training the dog and the guy is in the padding and he puts his arm out. Well, this is what was happening to the Secret Service time and time again. These agents were being attacked by the dog and their reaction is to defend themselves by putting their arm out to defend themselves. And the dog would latch on to the forearm or latch on to the elbow or the wrist. But what on earth is happening in a White House that would allow a dog to attack 24 Secret Service agents? I'm presuming they're all separate attacks. I would hope one person doesn't show up more than once on this list. And of course, they hid it from us. And it was only forced out thanks to your Judicial Watch. I'm going to read you a little more detail from the document. On June 15th, 2023, Deputy Assistant Secret Service Director Daryl Volpicelli is sent a report via email regarding an agent who received a, quote, deep bite, unquote, by Commander while inside the Kennedy Garden. The incident shut down East Wing tours for 20 minutes. Okay, so the public was affected by this as well. Video of the incident shows special agent, and they redact the name, entered the Kennedy Garden while Commander, who was off the leash and on the opposite side of the garden at the time, run at a high speed of rate towards the special agent, jumps towards him, and takes him to the ground. They redact his name throughout. The groundskeeper, who was also in the garden at the time, put Commander on a leash after the bite occurred. The special agent said that Redacted looked around the garden before entering it and did not see the family pet.
So I'm not quite sure who's talking there. The special agent sustained an injury to his left arm, deep bite, that reportedly needed stitches. He was treated by the White House medical unit at the residence clinic. East Wing tours were stopped for approximately 20 minutes due to blood from the incident being on the floors in the area of the booksellers. I'm not quite sure where the booksellers are. My guess is there's a White House little gift store. I think there is in the White House there. There's a January 28th, 2023 email chain that discusses three biting incidents in one day. Two days. Two incidents today and one yesterday, the email says. Including one of the Navy staff was bit at by the dog. So this is not just the Secret Service. Our armed forces are being attacked by Joe Biden's dog. Then there's a photo attached to the email from the Presidential Protection Division with the subject line, dog bite. The photo shows the torn clothing of an agent. I don't know if, I didn't ask our guys to pull this together. I don't know if they can pull that up quickly.
We'll work on it.
Yeah. And if we get it up, we'll show it to you. But you'll see it on our website either way. And there's another email where a senior Secret Service agent, basically the assistant special agent in charge of the Presidential Protection Division, which is the preeminent division in the Secret Service, my understanding is. This was a message to the team FLD, the First Lady Detail. The recent dog bites have challenged us to adjust our operational tactics when Commander is present. Please give lots of room, staying a terrain feature away if possible. Oh, wait, there's a picture of one of the shirts. Imagine you're wearing that. And you're bitten by, you know, and that's what the dog does. Can you imagine the damage underneath? So it gives lots of, so the senior guy is telling his team to keep a terrain feature away if possible. I mean, let's think about that. What does that mean? I don't know if that's Secret Service jargon or just in another room, be on the other side of the bushes, be away from your protectee. Is that what they're being told because the dog's out of control? We will continue to keep blank in our sight, but must be creative to ensure our own personal safety. So blank must be the First Lady, Jill Biden. The senior leaders of the detail and agency continue to address the issue at higher levels with staff and First Family, working to have a better solution soon. Thank you for your patience and understanding. So that's on July 29th. And by then, as I said, this goes up to six. This is from the date 10. This is almost from the moment they got the dog, it looks like. October 22. To June of 23. And even, by the way, after this list was compiled, after Judicial Watch disclosed these series of bites that we had found out about separately, 10 bites, turns out there were 23 they were hiding from us, a bite occurred. So they didn't do anything. This is the other bite, July 29th. Commander ran towards the direction of post, his booth, where the guy was, and bit him on the left forearm, causing a severe, deep, open wound. Do you all have? Have you ever seen a German Shepherd in person? I just can't believe this was happening. As a result of the attack, he started to lose a significant amount of blood, and he had to walk away looking for help, walking wounded in the White House, thanks to Joe Biden's dog. As I said in our press release, these dog attack documents again raise fundamental questions about President Biden and the Secret Service. This is a special sort of craziness and corruption where a president and first lady would allow their dog to repeatedly attack Secret Service and White House personnel. And rather than protect its agents, the Secret Service tried to illegally hide documents about the abuse of its agents and officers by the Biden family. That it took federal lawsuits to force the release of this information speaks volumes. The Bidens are lucky. They're lucky no one has been killed as a result of their reckless disregard for the safety of Secret Service and White House employees. Now, supposedly the dog's been removed. I don't know. And if you're the Bidens, if you're still working over there, you have to wonder, is there another dog floating around? Crazy town. And this is kind of like this judgment issue that I was talking about with Joe Biden. He's quoted recently, I should have pulled it up before I came on. He was just quoted recently that there was nothing to these dog bite stories. They're all exaggerated. I don't know what the exact quote was, but he pretended they weren't happening. So to me, this is a major scandal. Two dozen Secret Service agents were attacked by the dog, and nothing was done about it. Nothing was done about it. I talked about it in our CPAC speech. So now's the time for the CPAC speech. I think you're going to like it. It's about 15 minutes or so. So you should be able to tolerate listening to me talk 15 minutes. And it's prepared, so I don't meander that long and go out. But it was a big crowd, so let me give you the background. So Judicial Watch always sponsors CPAC. We've been doing it for the recent past. I guess it's going back at least 10 years we've been sponsoring CPAC now. And I usually make a presentation of some type, either via a panel or a direct speech. And President Trump was speaking the day I was making my presentation. And so you can imagine it's a big conference. You've all been at conferences before, and some speakers get more attention than others. And President Trump obviously is going to get the most attention, and the room's going to be full. And so people get there early. So I came out there to, for the first time, a completely full room. And it was a little bit off-putting, I have to say. I've done a lot of public speaking, but a crowd like that is unusual. And I was, a little bit taken aback at first. But I believe what I say. And we have a crisis, and I tried to describe it in succinct, powerful ways to the crowd. And you can see that there is a thirst for leadership. I'm not even a political leader, but there is a thirst for leadership. And I think when you see the way they respond to me, I always wonder, it's like, why don't the politicians talk like this? Because this is what people are concerned about, because I see it. And you're going to see it here with this CPAC speech about the current crisis and the threats to our republic.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome President of Judicial Watch, Tom Fitton.
Whoa. What a crowd. Good morning, CPAC. It feels like I'm the only one here not running for vice president. Although who knows what will happen, right? Maybe the FBI needs some help or a new director. How about that? Judicial Watch is your watchdog in Washington, feared by Democrats and Republicans alike. But frankly, you got to begin with some bad news. It's too late. The 2024 election has already been compromised by the Biden Democratic Party's unprecedented prosecutorial assault on the civil rights of President Donald J. Trump. There is a storm front of selective, vindictive, political, and anti-constitutional prosecutions going from Miami up through Fulton County, Georgia, to here in D.C., and of course up into New York. And the front has expanded to other states where lawyers, Republican Party officials, and volunteers are being harassed, sued, disbarred, and prosecuted for exercising their God-given First Amendment and other rights to dispute an election. You know, let me be clear. Moving to jail, the leading presidential candidate, seizing his assets, destroying his business, and keeping his name off the ballot are all about turning America into a one-party state. You know, by the way, isn't fraudulently using the 14th Amendment and falsely accusing Trump of insurrection to keep him off the ballot insurrection in itself? If those abusers want to play the insurrectionist game, then virtually the entire deep state left media and DC ruling class will have some questions to answer. But how do we overcome the election rigging? How do we overcome it? Well, Judicial Watch knows what to do. Sue them! Counting votes of ballots that arrive after Election Day, that invites voter fraud, undermines voter confidence, and it's illegal. We're suing two states, Mississippi and Illinois, to stop that lawlessness. And of course, we have to ensure voting rolls are clean, because dirty voting rolls can mean dirty elections. The rolls are a mess, but Judicial Watch's heavy lifting is getting results. Our historic election lawsuits and pressure have led to 4 million dirty names being removed from the voting rolls in the last year or so. That is huge. LA County confirmed they removed 1.2 million names from the rolls. One county. DC just removed 138,000 names. That's 15% of their entire voting list. Of course, more lawsuits are coming. And on top of that, we have to shut down the border invasion, the Biden border invasion. And we need to deport those illegal aliens as soon as possible. And here's a key reason why. Their mere presence will ensure increased power for leftist politicians and their allies. If passed as prologue, these millions of illegals could help ensure that leftists get dozens of extra seats in Congress after the next census. Our Congress should answer to American citizens, not invaders from abroad. Again, the formula for free and fair elections is simple, right? Number one is free Trump. The rest you also know: voter ID, citizenship verification, no mass mail-in voting, vote in person on Election Day, and no ballot harvesting. Again, and let's complete the count on Election Day. Not having final results on Election Day 2024 would be another disaster for voter confidence. You know, I got very upset again recently about January 6th. I was rewatching the video of the needless killing of Ashley Babbitt, the Air Force veteran, shot for no good reason by Lieutenant Michael Byrd of the U.S. Capitol Police. Now, I've watched those videos. I can't believe he just shot her dead like that. I just can't believe it. And few in this corrupt city give a rat's tail about that awful shooting. But millions of Americans care. And her family cares. I think her mom, Mickey, is still here at CPAC. Is Mickey here? Well, give her a round of applause anyway. God bless her. And that's why I'm so pleased Judicial Watch just filed a $30 million wrongful death lawsuit against the U.S. government. On behalf of the family of Ashley Babbitt, as our lawsuit states, the facts speak truth. Ashley was ambushed when she was shot by Lieutenant Byrd. Multiple witnesses at the scene yelled, "You just murdered her." Judicial Watch is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. I tell you what, if it takes 30 more years to get justice for Ashley, that will be time well spent. And the next honest president should provide pardons and commutations for the January Sixers prosecuted by the compromised and corrupted Biden Justice Department. And hey, where the heck are all the January 6th videos? Judicial Watch sued for them, and we're being stonewalled by Republicans in Congress and the Biden Justice Department. Unacceptable. Unacceptable. Speaker Johnson, call your office. Well, you know, I don't need to tell you, we're in Banana Republic territory now. The Biden administration, with its unprecedented and political prosecutions of Trump, is now officially a regime. You know, I've seen it up close. I've seen it up close. Not too long ago, I had a significant skin cancer surgery. And a few hours after I got home, I'm on the couch recovering, feeling sorry for myself, when the FBI comes knocking. They came knocking on my door with a grand jury subpoena from the Biden DOJ. The agents tried to be pleasant and helpfully pointed out that something had come for me from Amazon. I suspect I am the first person in American history to receive FBI notice of an Amazon package delivery. I ended up being hassled and abused by the special counsel team for 4 hours over Trump documents, my First Amendment rights, and what I had for lunch with President Trump. It was a partisan fishing expedition. Frankly, it was like having to spend a day on an MSNBC panel. But I knew why they brought me before that grand jury. It was payback and intimidation for daring to defend Trump against their abuse of power. But we weren't intimidated by the prosecutorial abuse. In fact, Judicial Watch sued and is in federal court now for the names of the top staff of Jack Smith's team. We want to know just who is helping the Biden administration rig our elections by abusing Trump and other innocents. Biden DOJ seems to think they can hire the likes of Michelle Obama or Adam Schiff and not have to tell the public. If you're wondering why the court should uphold the transparency law on Jack Smith, I'd call your attention to how Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade have been using their political prosecution of Trump to launder tax money to go on vacation sprees together. Are Jack Smith's team members biased or conflicted? Or are they unbiased, nonpartisan professionals? Well, they're hiding the names, so I think we all know what the answer to that is. And one more thing, if the regime is going to change the rules so Trump can be prosecuted, Obama must be prosecuted. And our elderly, well-meaning, with a failing memory president seems to have been the head of a family RICO operation for decades. Joe Biden is the most corrupt president since he was vice president. I mean, cocaine in the White House is the least of his problems. And did you see how Judicial Watch uncovered how Biden's dog bit dozens of Secret Service and White House personnel? What sort of crazy dog owner would allow his pet to bite and viciously attack repeatedly the men and women protecting his life? And of course, there's also serious evidence of criminal activity by the Justice Department, the FBI, and IRS, and those agencies' handling of Hunter and Joe Biden's criminal investigations. And Merrick Garland can't have it both ways on Biden's cognitive collapse. He should either reject the special counsel's conclusions that Biden is mentally unfit and prosecute him, or move forward with the vice president and fellow cabinet members to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove him. To accept the Hur report means Garland agrees Biden is unfit for the presidency, right? Now, we have over a dozen FOIA lawsuits on Biden family corruption, but I think we're going to still need to hire some more lawyers to keep up. You know, it's hard to imagine why a Republican-controlled House of Representatives would authorize one more dime in taxpayer money for the DOJ-FBI machine. In fact, it's hard to imagine why any House Republican would keep on funding the border invasion, the abuse of Trump, the censorship of Americans, the killing of the unborn, the transgender extremist abuse of our children, and the crazed critical race theory, DEI, in the Biden administration, especially in our military. Defund it all! I don't know about you, but a government shutdown would be well worth it if it means the end of Biden's border invasion. The good news is Judicial Watch remains powerful because of the rule of law. That's why the left wants to destroy the Supreme Court and hates so much Justice Thomas. I, for one, say loud and clear, God bless Justice Clarence Thomas. FOIA law allows us to investigate everything. The founders would be proud, I'd like to think. John Adams said, "Liberty cannot be preserved without a general knowledge among the people who have a right, an indisputable, unalienable, indefeasible, divine right to that most dreaded and envied kind of knowledge. I mean of the characters and conduct of their rulers." That's why Judicial Watch has filed thousands of FOIAs and hundreds of lawsuits to find out more about the characters and conduct of our rulers. We've sued on everything from Hillary's emails to the FBI spying on the church. Frankly, we can't sue enough. And if you have FOIA ideas or need FOIA help, let us know. You know, the left Borg wants us to think that resistance is futile to their dangerous anti-American agenda. But you know better. Fighting for America is never futile. It is our duty. It is our duty to stand strong for our children and the generations to come. It's the American way. So get up, stand up for freedom, stand up against the extremist left, stand up for our borders and our sovereignty, stand up against corruption, stand up for transparency, stand up for our children, stand up for life, stand up for the rule of law, stand up for free speech and your other God-given rights. Stand up for the Constitution and the American Revolution for liberty it represents. We have no choice but to win. You must all be heroes for the Republic. God bless you and God bless America. Thank you. Thank you.
Break the podium in half, but the crowd had a lot of energy there, and we had a bunch of friends there at CPAC. We had Kash Patel and Kerry Lake out from Arizona comment on our work. Let's run Kash Patel's and Kerry's
shots that we had from earlier.
I'm selfishly the hugest supporter of the Ashley Babbitt lawsuit. It's such an important critical step that you guys and Fitton let out on, because that wasn't popular. That was not an easy thing to do. Jan 6 is more than a third rail. The amount of production that you guys do in terms of documents and the FOIA work that you guys put out is critical, because that's the bread and butter of exposing corruption. It's not someone reading it and telling your audience what it is. It's getting them to touch and feel it. And I think Judicial Watch hits it out of the park on that front.
I am a huge supporter of Judicial Watch. I think you guys do great work. And you guys are really one of the first kind of fighting the corruption in D.C. and exposing it. So thank you for that.
Those were nice things said by Carrie Lake and Kash Patel. And if you support Judicial Watch, you can see that you're not alone from that crowd out in CPAC. And those of you who are not as familiar with our work, everything I talked about in that speech, Judicial Watch has litigation or documents or is really just taking a national leadership role on. And I encourage you to go to our website, find out more about what we're doing. And if you're not supporting Judicial Watch, you need to support our work. Because if we don't do it, virtually no one else will. And with that, I wish you the best, and I'll see you here next week for another Judicial Watch update.
Thanks for listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.